I am Stephen Spruill, staff writer for National Review and National Review Online.
And I'm Tim Fernholz. I'm a staff writer at the American Prospect, where we're both online and in magazine as well.
Excellent, excellent. And you and I are both, in addition to our day jobs, occasional contributors to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. We were both just in Ottawa for election night, doing some live television coverage, explaining the election returns and the crazy Tea Party phenomenon and the Republican sweep to bewildered Canadian television audience, just trying to make sense of it.
To be honest, I was embarrassed at how many Canadians who were there with us seemed to know way more about American politics than I even have the faintest grasp of Canadian politics.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. It was pretty fun. I had a really good time, and particularly in certain areas of policy, trade policy, I would guess that their knowledge goes pretty far beyond even wonkish types like you and I who pay pretty close attention to this stuff. On the subject of trade, there's a big G20 summit going on. We can get to that later, but I think first we wanted to talk about this big fiscal commission co-chair's mark, or the chairman's mark. Or I know there's been some some of the commentary about the document has some of the most contentious commentary about the document has revolved around what to call it. So. You want to explain that?
It's been interesting. So the commission is the one the president set up last year, and it's supposed to deliver its final report with 18 members sort of contributing, I guess, sort of signing up to support specific provisions on December 1st. And I guess from talking to folks on the commission staff, there were all of these worries about stuff leaking and things getting out of the commission, getting ahead of where they wanted it to be. And so, whenever you generally have a committee, and this is, I believe, mainly made up of members of Congress. There are some other folks who aren't, but it's certainly chaired by former members of Congress. And they will put together sort of a working paper called the Chairman's Mark. And that's what got released on Wednesday. And, of course, prompted great outcry for and against and confused from everyone. But it's not the final paper. I think it probably looks a lot like what the final paper will look like, although who's to say.
If this is what the final paper looks like, it's not going to get anywhere near the 14 votes that it needs kind of get a guaranteed vote in Congress.
You're absolutely right. I don't know. Do you know if it's the entire plan needs support of 14? My understanding was I thought that like individual provisions, if they had support of 14, would be mandated votes. I could be wrong.
I did not. Yeah, no, that's I don't know, because that might have been a separate agreement that was worked out with congressional leaders. As far as the executive order establishing the commission, to the best of my recollection, all it said was that the final, if for the commission's report to be considered, the report of the commission, it will have to have the support of 14 of the 18 members. Otherwise, the commission will not be considered to have released a report at all.
That explains a little bit better why this chairman's mark got released now, because they probably won't even be able to do that then.
Right. As far as I am aware, and I could be wrong, my reading of the executive order was that, they had to have a final report that had the support of 14 members in order for the commission to even be considered to have released a report. Otherwise, it would just, they would, I guess, go their separate ways. That's a pretty difficult job. I think that's why everybody was expecting such weak tea from this group, because in order to get the support of a commission that has as members both incoming budget committee chairman Paul Ryan and outgoing SEIU president Andy Stern, that's a pretty diverse panoply of visions for the size and scope of federal government and how to meet, anticipated budget shortfalls. So it explains a lot about the chairman's mark. They're they're, I think, probably trying to be pretty aggressive so that they can maybe light a fire under some of the members who are being recalcitrant about putting compromises on the table. I think they'd like to have a final document at the end of the day that they can at least have a vote on. And another thing I think it explains about the document is the fact, much commented on by both the right and left, that it really doesn't address health care in a very comprehensive way. There's a little bit of hand-waving about cost control and strengthening the Medicare panel that was set up by the Affordable Care Act, but other than that, it takes a kind of, you know, let's control costs and keep them to 1% of GDP, and that's how we'll deal with exploding Medicare costs. So I mean, I don't know. That's my take anyways, because healthcare seems to be the most contentious issue. If they're going to get a plan that gets, you know, 14 votes, they probably, you know, can't wholeheartedly embrace either one side or the other's vision of what to do about exploding healthcare costs.
Well, I'll tell you, on healthcare costs, I mean, I have a different take from you on that. And from what I've been talking to folks who supported the Affordable Care Act, they really see this plan as ratification of that. The cost control measures that have been put in the healthcare plan are very similar, as you said, to what's in this sort of proposal. And my one thing about this draft, and I think, you know, people should go look at it, we'll put a link on the side, it really is just a PowerPoint. There is not a lot to go on in terms of actually figuring out sort of the specifics of what it means. But, you know, I think the people, and I am referencing Hank Aaron here, Henry Aaron from Brookings, I think folks in the White House will tell you this. I talked to some people on the staff the other day. They really see it as sort of like endorsing cost control methods similar to the Affordable Care Act. And also they, which I think, you know, shouldn't surprise anyone, but they did say, look, we need to figure out, you know, how to fix the SGR, the doc fix, and do that in a way that isn't killing the deficit every 2 years when people just sort of vote that through. And that's one of those hard things, because doctors are, a constituency that are pretty powerful in U.S. politics. And, you know, that's why, you know, one of the things about the Affordable Care Act that disappointed people was it focused on insurance companies, it focused on reimbursement, but didn't focus so much on actual, like, medical practitioners cutting their costs. So if that's what comes out of this as the message on healthcare, that's important. I mean, I think almost everyone, and I think you'd agree with me here, Stephen, recognizes that growing Medicare costs are the problem, in long-term budgeting. I think the Affordable Care Act is a pretty good step forward in ratcheting those down, and insofar as this commission reinforces that, good for them. So I don't know where you think about that. I'm curious what you think about the spending cuts, both the mandatory and sort of the discretionary defense side. Do you think those are, how are those set up to your view?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that overall, I think the mix of spending cuts to tax increases envisioned in the plan is about right in terms of a compromise, at least that conservatives are going to feel comfortable with. And that's no small thing. I mean, so the ratio, as far as I understand it, and I know there's been, Bob Stein of First Trust Advisors has questioned on our blog whether the spending cuts are actually real or what kind of baseline they're coming down from. But it looks to me like about 75% spending cuts, 25% tax increases. That's about, I mean, I think that's about right. We talked a little bit about this on CBC on Wednesday when we did the panel. The mix is about right if you want to get the budget deficit under control without creating too much of a drag on growth. And I mean, of course, it's easy to say, you know, well, what are conservatives really giving up? Well, they're giving up a lot in terms of taking on, you know, elements of the movement to whom, you know, that no tax increase of any kind can be countenanced. And you've already seen Grover Norquist and Americans for Tax Reform come out and absolutely blast this plan with the same vehemence that somebody like Paul Krugman on the left has blasted it. To them, you know, any tax
well, you can't take
tax,
Grover Norquist
tax increases is unacceptable.
I think, you know, unfortunately, you just can't. I mean, he is not serious about cutting the deficit. And he's serious about shrinking the size of government as much as he can, except he's not, because he does support policies that just blow up the deficit. Well, I think you know, it is, I think the mix, and what I wrote about this morning, I think the mix that I sort of identified is it's about $600 billion in spending cuts from 2012 to 2015, but you only get $174 billion in tax revenue deficit reduction. And that's about 60-30, and that's not counting some of the other sort of interest, savings from interest and things like that. But I think problem with it is sort of a couple things. What you said, I think, and I quoted this from CBC the other day, was I think you said it's the right mixture of spending and tax cuts for an austerity budget. And, you know, I think I recognize the research you were citing. I think who came out with that? Was it the IMF basically saying that this is the mix we like? But I think what I would challenge, and a lot of liberals might, is that does the United States need an austerity budget? I don't think we do. I think we need deficit reduction over the long term so we can have a sustainable fiscal path. But do we need an austerity budget right now with interest rates so low and no problems borrowing? I'm not sure that's necessary. I don't think that we're in such danger of default that that's what we want.
Well, I still think even if you talk about long term, and I think you'll get a lot of people on the left to acknowledge this as well. And in fact, I mean, I get the distinction that you're making, which is why a lot of these steps that are endorsed by the chairman's report really don't kick in, until the window is pretty far out. I think they endorse right up front in their statement of guiding principles that none of this stuff should really start to take effect until the next couple of years, a couple of years out. Wait and see how the economic recovery goes. But I mean, I think even in general, I guess I used the word austerity, in our debate a couple of days ago. But I think that even long term, over the long term, the incentive effects of tax increases or tax cuts are even more pronounced. And so I think it's even more important to make sure that the whereas spending cuts are not as big a deal, because even from the Keynesian frame of analysis, the spending stuff is really about short term economic stimulus to get over the hump, to get to the point where a recovery can be self-sustaining. So if you're talking about long-term deficit reduction, I think it's even more important to weight the package towards spending cuts that over the long term are not going to destimulate, versus tax increases where over time, as people can anticipate to keep less or more of every dollar that they earn, I think those incentive effects become pretty pronounced.
Well, just talking about the tax reform part, and this is, I think, the one thing that concerns me, and one of the things is I want to wait for an actual analysis of the distribution of how they're going to do the tax reform. But the commission's sort of original, they mentioned the Wyden Gregg plan for tax reform, and they also mentioned the sort of Democles idea where they're going to put like massive tax increases hanging over the head of the Ways and Means Committee and sort of force them to deal with it. I think that's probably not going to work. But what they did do, which is interesting, is they just cut all tax expenditures and then said, if we want to add them back in, this is what your tax rate is going to look like. And the way they did that, I think that's a good place to start. And I think there are certain things that are sacred cows, and one of them is the earned income tax credit that it's absolutely off the table. I can't imagine that you would be able to pass something that gets rid of the EITC. But it's probably possible, looking at this, that you could end up having deficit reduction go through and have people end up with lower taxes at the end. And in fact, one of the parts of this plan, and it says this, is as a result of this tax reform, it's going to dedicate a portion of savings to deficit reduction and apply the rest to reduce all marginal tax rates. Now, I don't understand why we don't take the entire savings from this tax reform and dedicated to deficit reduction, and maybe when that's done, we talk about lowering everybody's tax rate. Because you don't see in the spending cut section, we're going to cut all of this spending and then dedicate a portion to deficit reduction and a portion to healthcare subsidies, maybe, which is essentially what the Affordable Care Act did. It cut, costs in Medicare, or it's trying to, and rededicating a portion of that to healthcare subsidies. So what you see
partly it's political, and then partly there's an economic argument for it, too. I mean, there's the pro-growth, lower rates over time, encourage growth. I'm not here, I should stress, endorsing a naive supply-sider view that tax cuts pay for themselves. But I mean, they do. The revenue effects of tax cuts are, tend to be, I think, pretty consistently understated, simply because, there are growth effects to lower tax rates. And the other is political. If you're going to start slaughtering sacred cows left and right, like the mortgage interest deduction, you're going to have to give people something in return. And I think lower rates are pretty much the way that you sell a package, as controversial as that, to people. You're talking about broadening the tax base but lowering rates. I think in general those principles are get a pretty wide consensus of economists in terms of what you want in a comprehensive tax reform.
Well, I think that's you get a consensus if you're talking about tax reform. But when you're talking about deficit reduction, and I think, the thing is, you're going to have to get people on board, and you're going to have to sweeten the pie for them or whatever. But I think what liberals are questioning looking at this is why is the ratio the way it is? And why is it that it's not looked at as we're just doing deficit reduction? I mean, again, and I want to wait and see an analysis of what the effective tax impact is actually going to be once we get rid of all of the various exclusions. And maybe it'll end up, people will have, a similar tax burden but a more efficient one. I'm actually surprised, one thing that I like that I have not seen as much outcry as I expected is they're talking about taxing capital gains and dividends as regular income, and that's certainly a sacred cow as well.
Yeah, I'm not so wild about that. I mean, look, you've got a lot of conservatives kind of hemming and hawing about the exact structure of the tax reform package. But in general, I think, and I mean, I'd like to get your view on this. The reactions of the right and the left, I think, have been pretty stark. On the right, you've had a couple of tantrums. You've had, Grover Norquist saying this is absolutely unacceptable. And then you've had also some substantive concerns raised. But I think in general, it's been greeted pretty optimistically. And that's a big deal. I mean, talking about, I know that, the idea of, capping revenue at 21% of GDP has caused a lot of heartburn on the left, but at the same time, I mean, it's just a fact that that's much higher than the historical average has been in the United States. It's averaged in the post-war era about 18%. So to get conservatives to accept that this is the new normal, that the government's going to be taking 21% GDP in revenue as opposed to 18 or 19%, that's a pretty big compromise, I feel, for conservatives. And I think you've got conservatives who are like 75% there.
I mean, I don't understand why that's necessary. I don't think we should set a cap on it. I think we need to have a conversation about how much revenue the government should have and not be arbitrary about it. And I think that's what worries people also about the discretionary spending cap, because even though the commission suggests things they'd like to see cut, all they're legislating is a cap. So when it gets down to doing, the cutting, do you think it's going to be the good government stuff, or do you think it's going to be whoever has the most political interest wins? And I think that's...
Yeah, I know. We have to look to the past for lessons on that, and unfortunately the past teaches us to be very pessimistic about that. I mean, we had discretionary spending caps put in place when Congress decided to yank the teeth out of Graham Rudman Hollings in 1990. They put discretionary spending caps in place, and those were just kind of gradually weakened over time until 2002, at which point I say with no amount of pride whatsoever that a Republican Congress let the Budget Enforcement Act lapse. So no PAYGO, no discretionary spending caps, no discipline of any kind on spending. So, I mean, when I – that was actually one of my well, I won't say least favorite parts, because there were, you know, there were other things that I thought were not that great about the proposal. But the idea that you're going to get this done legislatively by raising points of order and enforcing discretionary spending caps, it's better than what we have now. But historically, Congress has just ignored those whenever they've really wanted to exceed them.
And so, I think that's not... what worries liberals too, is that all of the changes to the tax code and Social Security and healthcare, those are just sort of legislated outright. But on the spending side, it's sort of constructing this framework where maybe it will happen. And I think there's uncertainty there. I mean, just to get back to your original point about the varying responses on the right and the left, I mean, I think it's because, you know, people on the right like it because it primarily plays to their strengths. It's a document that talks about making government smaller, not for the purpose of making government more effective, but just for the sake of making it smaller. And, you know, again, I think I'm pretty reasonable on this. I'm ready for a grand bargain. I'm ready to cut spending. I'm ready to look at entitlement programs. But it's, you know, and I realize also that 50-50 isn't going to happen. And that's fine. But I think the balance that we're seeing now is what worries liberals. And I think, you know, if you look across the left, there's a lot of people who are saying there's good stuff in this and we can engage with this. But it's not done yet, I guess I would say. And it's surprising. I've seen a lot of outcry on the right about Nancy Pelosi coming out and saying, I don't like this document. I don't think I can support it. But, you know, I didn't see anyone getting the vapors a few weeks ago when, you know, who was it? I think it was Eric Cantor said there will be no compromise on the Bush tax cuts. I mean, saying that you won't compromise is not, you know, something limited to one party. And that's the other thing. This budget, the baseline actually assumes that the Obama compromise on the Bush tax cuts goes forward. So it's going to be an even worse baseline if, you know, I think as people are projecting that those taxes are either extended or at, you know, 2 years or 1 year, however they end up doing it.
Well, particularly if, and I think this was a question that was raised by that Bob Stein post I referenced earlier, I mean, particularly if it also assumes Obama's preferred level of spending as expressed by this year's budget document. You know, I mean, I think that also is a question of whether or not, you know, they start from the elevated baseline for discretionary spending envisioned by that document, or whether they start from something like the current baseline if you know, Congress just passed a CR. But that actually is going to, you know, raise some interesting questions when it comes to the lame duck session. I personally think, and you know, quickly say about Cantor's remark, you know, it's going to be frustrating for people who care about a lot about policy, because almost all of the there's going to be so much argumentation devoted to these Bush tax cuts in the next few months. And meanwhile, you know, this fiscal commission has put forward some really solid ideas about you know, fundamental tax reform that we need. The Bush tax cuts are just almost so secondary to that larger conversation that needs to happen. I think there should be pretty broad agreement on that. I was happy to see there was a story in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago. You know, the compromise that seems to be emerging among moderate Democrats and Republicans in the Senate is, you know, Kent Conrad and Max Baucus saying, hey, let's just extend the Bush tax cuts for 2 years. Let's extend all of them. Let's just avoid this fight. And then, you know, in return, let's all kind of agree amongst ourselves to take up to make fundamental tax reform, you know, a big, you know, something that we address in the next 2 years, something that we address in the next Congress. Let's get at least that part of it done. And if it looks anything like, you know, what the fiscal commission has proposed, then that's going to involve, you know, broadening the base, lowering rates, and doing something that I think we can disagree about, you know, details here and there. I don't really like the increase in capital gains taxes, but you know, nobody's going to be at the end of the day happy with everything that happens. Right. And I think that kind of thing, much more than just extending the Bush tax cuts for 2 years, would be really good for the economy.
Well, here's the thing, you know, I'm anti-punting. I don't like this deficit commission because ultimately what it's trying to do is do what the budget committee should be doing, and you know.
Yeah.
If it becomes a venue for good ideas, and in some ways it has, I think that's great. But ultimately, it was supposed to find a political solution, and it looks like it's not going to. And I think the same thing with That sort of agreement you just referenced. I mean, I guess, sure. I would not trust Congress to do, you know, tax reform based on a handshake in the next 2 years. And frankly, you know, for my druthers, I think we'd be more likely to see tax reform if Congress deadlocks, the Bush tax cuts all expire, and suddenly everybody has an incentive to lower the rates and get this right again. I mean, I think if you extend the Bush tax cuts and give, you know, the Republicans what they want, what incentive do they have to do tax reform? They'll well, sit I mean, for 2 years and run it, against President Obama in 2012 on the platform of extending the tax cuts.
I have to admit, I mean that does look like the political motivation for having them expire in 2 years. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's true. Well, I mean, I think we should address the lame duck session and just talk about this. And I mean, we were going to talk about G20 before that, but
let's go straight into the lame duck because that's relevant.
Let's just
let's set the stage for our world-shaking deficit reform.
right. You know, from these large ideas in the deficit commission's report, but down to some very very mundane nuts and bolts legislating, which is how is Congress going to fund the government once the current funding for the government expires on December 3rd. And yeah, whether or not they're going to extend the Bush tax cuts, I guess we already had that a little bit of that conversation. Although I still am not clear at all what the Obama administration's position is. David Axelrod saying that he's ready to compromise. He's saying that he's not.
That David Axelrod interview was the most overblown thing I've ever seen. I hope that Sam Stein and Howard Feynman will release the transcript of that interview because if you read the story, the headline is pretty far out ahead of the pegs. I think the only direct quote about the tax cuts is we have to look at the world we're in. Well, that's fine. I mean, I'm going to go with what, you know, White House officials have said on the record directly about it. I mean, I'm sure Axelrod is, you know, laying. I mean, look, there could be a change in plans, and he's saying we're going to deal with it when he does. It's a pragmatic White House, but I think it's too early to say, you know, the Obama administration's position has changed based on one sort of vaguely worded interview. You know, I think if Sam and Howard had the dirt on this tax policy, they would have a direct quote or something instead of sort of suggestion and innuendo. So who knows? I mean, what that does do, the practical effect of that, was it got progressive activists completely up in arms about tax reform and the Bush tax cut. So if anything, it's sort of retrenched their position against the supposedly wishy-washy White House, which I think is not so wishy-washy as others might think. So that I don't give a ton of credit. I mean, I think the Obama proposal is still what it was before. Extend middle class, meet in the middle on capital gains and dividends, and the upper income tax breaks. And I would add that those middle class tax breaks are still upper income tax breaks because of the way taxation works in the United States. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I don't know. Here's my, I mean, and this is all very, very speculative based on a not large sample of members of congressional aides, staffers, GOP staffers that I've talked to. Again, not a large sample, just a handful that I've pinged to find out, you know, because, you know, here at the magazine, when we were putting together our post-election issue, we were trying to figure out, you know, like, what is the spending fight going to look like? And my view is this. I feel like the Democrats have the you know, they don't have a lot of gas in the tank after the defeat that they just suffered, and so I think they have the strength for maybe one big political fight. You know, they can either, you know, make the Bush tax cuts their hill to die on, or they can try for one last big omnibus spending package that gets a lot of their priorities through the Congress in a lame duck session as part of a must-pass bill to fund the government, because, you know, the GOP, very sensitive to what happened in 1995, does not want their first, even though they're not in charge yet, you know, I think that there's not a lot of stomach there for a government shutdown, which is what will happen if we don't have a spending bill passed by December 3rd. So, you know, the Democrats' options on spending are these. They can pass an omnibus spending bill, just a big, bundled up bunch of appropriations bills, and they can use that as a vehicle, you know, to establish a lot of their priorities in legislation and do so in a way that would be very difficult for the GOP to undo in 2011. That is, I think, what they would prefer to do. Even some Republicans on the Appropriations Committee would prefer to do that because they've got a lot of earmarks and they can put earmarks in an omnibus in a way that they can't do in a continuing resolution, which basically just funds the government at the same levels it's being funded for the next year. The third option is the second option would be just a continuing resolution, just punt until next September and say we're just going to fund fiscal year 2011 at the same levels. The Democrats don't really want to do that. The appropriators don't want to do that. That doesn't give them a chance to put in a bunch of new earmarks. And this is why you've had a little fight over earmarks break out already among Republicans. The third option, though, is a continuing resolution that funds the government at current levels only until like February. So like a short-term continuing resolution that only covers, you know, half the year. And I think that if Democrats were smart, and I hope that, you know, nobody in power is watching right now. I hope no members
of Democrats. Nancy, are you tuning in?
No. Don't listen to this. Maybe I should say, but no. I mean, if they were smart, this is what they would do, right? Because, first of all, they avoid a big showdown right now. They can save their powder for a fight on taxes if they want to have that fight. But more importantly, this saddles Republicans in February with having to fight two battles simultaneously. One, you know, they're going to have to appropriate the money for the rest of the fiscal year, right? So they're going to be having to do last year's budget, and also, you know, February and March is when Congress has their own budget fight. So that's when Paul Ryan's going to be bringing some very bold proposals to the floor that, you know, he's not only going to have to fight Democrats on, but get Republicans to support as well. So you're having this year's budget fight and next year's budget fight all at the same time in February. That's going to be very difficult.
Of a terrifying future dystopia.
Yeah,
I'm not excited.
If you're a Republican, it's not something that you're going to want to be dealing with. It's not how you want to spend your February. Because the Tea Party, activists that provided so much of the gasoline for this election are going to expect cuts, and they're going to expect them right away. And it's very hard to enact cuts in the middle of the fiscal year because all of the cuts have to occur in the last half of the year. Mm-hmm. So if you want to achieve real savings, it means, you know, big time layoffs and whole programs eliminated, which is what a lot of Tea Partiers want to see. But it's very, very difficult politically to implement on that scale in a short period of time. So I mean, if the Democrats were smart, that's probably what they would do, because it leaves kind of a time bomb for Republicans just as they're trying to kind of get their majority underway.
Well, that's some pretty savvy analysis right there. I mean, I can't say that I've looked into this as much as you have, but it does seem like that's a good idea. I think my question, though, is, you know, the Republicans have demonstrated, regardless of the Democrats' majorities thus far, that they can really sort of, you know, control the pace of what the Democrats do. And I don't know that they will sort of let them do that if they try. It'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see if they try and force a vote on this tax cut. Or, you know, do you think it's better for the Republicans to try and find a tax deal in the lame duck or next spring?
Well, I mean, that's a really good question, and unfortunately, I don't really know. And here's why: because on the one hand, you could say, okay, look, maybe it would be good politics for the Republicans to just put their foot down in the Senate, say absolutely no to any compromise. Let the Bush tax cuts expire on January 1st, and then when they take power in the middle of January, you know, make their first order of business extending all of the Bush tax cuts. That seems like it would work, but I've actually talked to a couple of experts who have said that, you know, because of the way that companies do their payrolls, that would really mess things up. Because they have to have everything kind of lined up on January 1st for withholding, and so the Republicans would get blamed for causing some really big problems at some, you know, major employers, big companies that have big payrolls. I don't know how that would play out. It might blow up in the Republicans' faces politically if that kind of thing caused major problems. But you know, I mean, I feel like What's most likely, at least, you know, this is what, according to what I've read in the newspapers, is this, you know, the scenario that was laid out by this Wall Street Journal story where, you know, you've got, you know, very powerful Democrats in the Senate saying, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go ahead and extend them for 2 years, extend them all for 2 years, and then in exchange for some kind of promise for a vote on fundamental tax reform. And I think ultimately the administration will sign whatever comes out of Congress, because they're not going to want to get in the way of that train.
Maybe. You know, as we discussed earlier, it seems like a terrible idea for the Democrats to do that, because I can't imagine the Republicans coming back and being, oh, sure, we'll vote on your tax reform now that we have everything that we want. The math doesn't add up to me there.
No, and those little informal compromises that are brokered, you know, they don't always...
Believe it or not, parties and primaries.
Right. Believe it or not, sometimes the members of Congress have their fingers crossed behind their back. So,
members of Congress misleading people.
I know.
Self-impressive.
It's shocking. You heard it here first on Blogging Heads TV. I feel like we have we've just shocked and disillusioned an entire audience of Blogging Heads viewers.
Sorry, guys. Hate to bring it up. Yeah. Well, I want to. You know, I guess, you know, you mentioned earlier this idea that the Democrats are going to try and force through all of these, I think you mentioned the Employee Free Choice Act, you know, and other people have been talking about immigration reform or the an energy bill or something. And it just seems weird to me that people think, you know, that Democrats have been waiting. You know, they had just sort of been waiting the last 2 years to pass these things when there's sort of real reasons
they didn't.
I think one thing that's going to come up in the lame duck is the DREAM Act, which is an act that would give the children of illegal immigrants a path to citizenship if they pursue a college education or serve in the military. And it's, you know, definitely sort of a case where, you know, one, I mean, I think it's a, you know, an issue of fundamental justice. But obviously for the Democrats, there is political benefit there and a thank you to Hispanic voters and Latino voters who really helped them out in Nevada and across the Southwest and wherever they could. And I'm curious, they tried to have a vote on that earlier, but it didn't come up. Do you think that's something the Democrats could do as sort of a step towards immigration reform?
It depends. I mean, I really hate to cop out like that, but it's true that, you know, even the people in Congress that I'm talking to are like, we don't know. You know, I mean, Harry Reid hasn't even met yet. I think he's scheduled to meet with his caucus on Tuesday to decide, you know, what their priorities are going to be for the lame duck session. I don't think it's impossible. I mean, I think of all of the Democrats' ideas on immigration and of all the policies, and look, I mean, here's the problem is that you're not going to get a lot of disagreement from me on this, because I'm a little bit of a squish, but I do think, I mean, I do think that you have to take into account that there are going to be unintended consequences. You are going to be encouraging more, you know, more illegal immigration the more that you reward it. I mean, that's, you know, like I said, I understand the justice aspect of the argument that you're making. You know, obviously the personal stories of some of these children of immigrants are very you know, heartwarming and sad at the same time. You know, to see that, you know, they've worked so hard to get through college and now have to take menial jobs because they still cannot get citizenship, and this wasn't really their fault. I agree it wasn't their fault, but their parents engaged in a behavior that was, you know, against the laws of this country, and by rewarding that, you know, you are going to be encouraging more of it. So I mean, that's just the policy case against it. And I see both sides. And as for whether or not they'll try it, if they're going to try anything on immigration, this would be what they would try. You know, because like I said, because it does have that kind of appeal to you know, to independents, to people who don't have their minds made up. And if they're going to do it, they have to do it in the lame duck.
Yeah, it's not happening.
Because it's not. There's no way that something like that is getting through a newly Republican House. Just no way.
One other lame duck thing I wanted to ask you about was if you could explain to me how John McCain became such a political genius. He is getting Carl Levin, the current, I guess, the future chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. to strip the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal out of the Defense Appropriations Bill, despite the fact that it's supported by something like 70% of Americans, and despite the administration and Senator Harry Reid's commitment to repealing it, and this survey that's coming out showing that most of the troops don't actually think it's a very important policy. So how has Senator John McCain single-handedly, it seems like, managed to get this repeal just sort of taken right out of the Senate?
I have no idea. It beats me. I mean, that's not an issue that I pay too much attention to or feel very strongly one way or the other about. So I mean your guess is as good as mine. I don't know. Is Carl Levin up for re-election in 2012? I thought he was a 2014 guy. In any case, maybe it's just part of the regular horse trading that happens in.
I gotta get me some horses.
You know, in Congress. Yeah, right. Speaking of horse trading,
yeah.
You know, this is something, and hopefully, you know, might be a good segue into. We don't have a ton of time left, but we did want to talk a little bit about some G20 stuff. Congressional horse trading. Back in 2007, the Bush administration negotiated a whole bunch of free trade agreements. Well, only four, actually, not a whole bunch. But, you know, you had Peru, Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. And then U.S. Trade Ambassador Susan Schwab went down to Charlie Rangel, who had just been named the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and traded some horses and said, we will incorporate all of your demands on labor and environmental standards into these four deals if you will give us a vote on them. And Charlie Rangel said, okay. They announced the deal with a lot of fanfare. The New York Times did a big story about it, and everybody thought that was going to work. But then election year politics and recession politics came into play. They got the Peru deal passed, but the other three became victim to kind of a new wave of protectionist sentiment that accompanied the financial crisis and the ascendancy of the Democrats. And so Obama is now trying to revive this, revive some of these agreements, specifically the agreement with Korea. He's in Seoul, Korea, right now at the G20, but he failed to get his concerns addressed. And you know, Korea said, look, we already have a deal. We already negotiated a deal. We're not going to reopen it. Your concerns are not really worth our time. And so the headlines, at least, that people are reading coming out of this G20 are so far that, you know, Obama has already, even before the conference really began, failed to achieve one of his priorities. I don't know if you had any thoughts about that. I've written about this in a piece that's up today. I think that Obama should just, you know, if there's some kind of little face-saving compromise he can negotiate, that's fine. But the deal was very good as it was. He inherited a lot of bad things from Bush, but this was not one of them. It's a deal that would add an estimated $10 to $12 billion to annual GDP, and he just needs to get this thing done. He just needs to get it signed. And you know, his objections, which are made on behalf of the automakers, you know, that is an industry that has already gotten enough help. And really, it's not something that needs to be addressed in this agreement. So I think he needs to drop his objections, stop puppeting around for the automakers, and just sign this deal.
Well, you know, he has made this a bit of a priority, and, you know, that was a failure, I think, at South Korea. And I think the whole G20 was a bit of a mess this time around. If you've seen the communique that came out, it really is just sort of, we'll talk about it next year. We don't want to talk about it now.
Right.
I mean, on the South Korea trade deal, I am not as familiar with you are with the specifics of their objection. I feel like if Charlie Rangel was okay with it, then probably most Democrats would be. I think, though, that not bringing it back may have saved him some political trouble here at home. While obviously there are Democrats who are concerned about free trade, and there are actually a lot more Republicans who are sort of leery about free trade than I think most people are sort of ready to admit, if you believe public opinion surveys. About half of people in both parties are objecting to free trade agreements, especially now with the economy being what it is and people blaming foreign the top reason for our economy's troubles have been foreign free trade agreements in some opinion mm-hmm. polls. So I think on a technocratic level, it probably would have been good for the president to come back with some deal from South Korea. I don't know how he mm-hmm. would have gotten it through Congress.
Well, yeah, and I mean that's you know, it would have been difficult. I think he would have gotten it. Well, the problem is that, you know, the main objection had to do with automobiles, and it had to do with the fact that you know, even though this agreement under this agreement, South Korea would eliminate their tariffs on U.S. made cars and trucks. It's just the case that South Korea has much higher fuel economy and emission standards than we do. And the U.S. automakers were actually complaining that these regulations are structured in a way that acts as a non-tariff barrier to cars and trucks that are made in the United States. So I found that kind of amusing.
Well, that is
ridiculous. Yeah, that here Obama has finally found an emission standard that's too high. I don't know if I should be, you know, angry about the deal or popping a champagne bottle because he's finally found one that he didn't like. But I mean, yeah, that's pretty ridiculous. But unfortunately, and you talk about the composition of the new Republican majority, you know, incoming Ways and Means Committee chairman is Dave Camp of, wait for it, Michigan, yep. And he's one of the Republicans who is, you know, on board with the automakers' case against this deal. So, you know, that, you know, the trade deal would kind of have to start, I think, in his committee. And, if he's not happy with it, then it's not going to go anywhere, which, you know, might be one reason why the Obama administration, despite the kind of absurdity of their position, going over to South Korea and lecturing them on their too high environmental standards, you know, he had to go and do it if he wanted a victory here. So, you know, I agree, it's going to be interesting. You know, and this kind of brings the conversation full circle as well, because, you know, one of the things that we were talking about in Canada on election night was, you know, are these Republican, these new Republicans, are they going to be as free trade as the old Republicans, or does the Tea Party really, you know, is the Tea Party opposed to free trade? Are they suspicious? And, you know, the polls that you cited just now, it doesn't seem good. Doesn't seem like a good
and,
thing.
You know, the one thing that I think should give hope to those of us who see a future of multilateral trading and global cooperation is that, you know, these things are cyclical. I think, you know, God willing and Congress cooperating, somehow we have an economic recovery in this country. I think you'll see sentiments against trade go back down again. I think it's when people aren't doing well, they look for someone to blame, and you know, foreigners are pretty easy. See that in a lot of unfortunate settings. So maybe, right, you know, once we have recovery going forward, there'll be more opportunity for work on stuff like this. And I don't think the administration is done with it yet. I think it's one of the big package of things that's a question mark from the Republicans in Congress right now. And if it turns out that the Republican majority in the House and the increased Republican presence in the Senate are willing to work on some of these things, on trade deals like that, or on any of these budget and tax schemes we've been discussing, you know, maybe we'll see some progress.
Right.
I think we just don't know.
I hope so. Well, it will be interesting to watch it unfold, and hopefully it's been interesting to the viewers to watch us blather on about it. I've enjoyed it, as always, Tim. Good to talk
it
to you.
It is a pleasure, Stephen.
All right.
You have a nice day. Goodbye, blogging.
I'll see you on Canadian TV.
As always.
All right. Bye.